obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
My name is Nell, and I'm a very, very grateful member of Al-Anon.
Hi, Nell.
It's wonderful to be here, just wonderful. When Jean called me, when was that, Jean? December, January, sometime.
Yeah.
We had much to share with one another because Jack had just died and Cleve died in December. And when she gave me the invitation, I thought, well, you know, maybe that'll give me something to look forward to. And it has. And I've looked forward to being here and seeing all of you that I've known over the years and the new friends that I've made. Vicki met us at the plane, and she's been wonderful, wonderful hostess. And, I didn't tell my friends I was going to do this, but I'm going to introduce them, and I'm going to have them stand. Please. Come on. Yeah. Yeah. The tall brunette is my neighbor, and Monica has been my friend for some time now, after she moved to Waurika. They're very special people in my life because while Cleve was ill, he fell a lot. Rinda, my neighbor, would come pick him up. Now you understand why he fell so much. But you know, I'm so grateful to them for, they even volunteered to come with me on this trip. I think maybe they thought I would do something embarrassing and wind up on CNN. And the whole town of Waurika, you know how big we are now, would be embarrassed. So they're looking after me, and it's very wise to travel with young, smart, beautiful women when you're my age, because I can be as senile as I want to and they look after me, you know. It's great. And of course, when we got here, we started running into people that I knew. I had dinner with Betty Ann and Bob last night, and Chris, and it's overwhelming. I feel so surrounded by your love and your caring. But that's what you've always shown me when I come out here. And I know how hard people work on these things, and I thank all of you who had any part of making this convention what it is for me today. And David, are you here? Well, you know how AAs are. Skip out. His sponsor called me this morning from Dallas to wish me happy birthday. And he told me to tell David that it might be a good idea to get in touch with his sponsor a little more than he's been doing. So thought I'd share that with you. Wait till I tell him he didn't come to the Al-Anon luncheon. How many are new? No one? Good. Wonderful. I love you new ones. And I'll tell you why. You're the ones that keep this program alive, and I want it to stay alive for me. I have a journey ahead, and I'm going to need you again. And, I want you to know that because I'm standing here, I am not an Al-Anon guru. I know some of you think I am, but I'm not. I'm simply here to share my experience, strength, and hope with you. And my story isn't really very different from all the people in this room. We simply talk about how we were, what happened, and how our life is today. And so that's what I'll try to tell you, because the gifts of this program have been so many for me. And this is a way we give back, by sharing what you've already given to us. I can tell you right now that I did not plan or dream to grow up and marry an alcoholic. I was raised in a wonderful home. What is the saying? A fine Christian home. And had a beautiful mother and a wonderful father, and they adored me. I felt loved from the time I was born. And I was an only child for about 6.5 years. And when my brother came, I knew that I did not lose that place in their heart. I had my own special place, and I was not jealous of him. However, he was the cause of a lot of misery in my life when he started to walk and talk. But I've forgiven him. And I hope he's forgiven me for just knocking the soup out of him. You know, I was good at that. But you know, we wonder how we got this way. How did we become the kind of people we became during the disease of alcoholism? And I thought back, and I remembered that I was a manipulator. As a very young child, I was a manipulator, simply because I didn't like the word no. And I could change my father's nose with a little eyelash energy and chin quivering. But mother was not that easy. And also, she punished me from time to time. And when she did, I cried. And I told for years that she put me in the closet. She did not. She went with me to hear me talk one time and straightened everyone out on that. She said, I never put her in the closet. That was where she chose to go. So, but I did. I stood in her closet and cried and blew my nose on her dresses. You know, the first time I did that, the most wonderful feeling came over me. And I know now that was revenge. So, here I am, what, 2-3 years old. I know how to manipulate, and I know how to get even. I was working on it from the very beginning, wasn't I? But I grew up during the war years, the big one, and I don't mean World War I, so. And life was simple. Life was really, really simple. I was born during the Depression, and I was grateful to know that I did not cause it. You know how we get, so. But during those years, I can remember a closeness in a community in this small town of Ryan, Oklahoma, where I grew up, and how people truly cared for one another. And I can remember when families would get word that a son had been killed in action or missing in action. And I can remember how the town gathered together and mourned with them and supported them. And also, I remember the movies. I loved the Flyboys. I was about 12, 13, 14 years old, and I would watch those movies, and I was so in love with Alan Ladd. Found out later he was a short alcoholic. So, anyway, attracted to him from the very beginning, I guess. And after the war, a friend of mine, who was a couple of years older, attending the University of Oklahoma, invited me up for the weekend. I was 16. And here the guys were all back from the war, and I knew she had written this young man. And I think he wrote to her when her brother was killed. And he grew up in Waurika, 10 miles away. And she told me, she said, I have a date for you with Cleve. I said, golly, that good-looking pilot? I was so thrilled. You know, being a planner and dreamer, my dreams were coming true. And I didn't dare tell my dad because he barely let me date at 16. But anyway, I got to Norman for the weekend, and the guys picked us up. And gosh, there he stood. Tweed coat, Argyle socks, fraternity pants, smoking a pipe. I didn't know at the time he had a flask in his hip pocket. But, you know, just like I planned and dreamed. The only thing I had to scratch out was tall. And what a wonderful evening. We went to a little place and we danced. Ah, he was a good dancer. And he told me how he won the war. And I believed him, of course. And during the evening, I sat there and I thought, I'm in pretty big company. I wonder if he'll try to kiss me when he takes me to the door, you know. And I started getting nervous because I didn't know about that. Well, the evening ended. He took me to the door, kissed me on the cheek, gave me a nickel and told him to call him when I became of age. So, you know, I thought that was so cute then. Showed you I was the beginning, didn't it? But anyway, my sophomore year in college and his senior year in law school, we started dating again when the college kids were all home during Christmas vacation. And then I invited him to our sweetheart dance at my school. I went to a girls' school. You might know my dad had sent me there. And at that dance, we went out on the balcony, big veranda of a place out from the ballroom. And he asked me to wear his fraternity pin, just like I planned and dreamed. Was wonderful. And then he started talking about, or we started talking about getting married. And he said, perhaps we should wait until November. I will have passed the bar exam by then, and then we can start our life together. You know, I always wanted to be a June bride. I was. And he was finishing, I think, some tax law classes that summer. But we had a wonderful, wonderful summer. And then in the fall of the year, he passed the bar. I did not know then that that would be the only bar he would pass for years to come. But, you know, he drank a little too much sometime, but I thought that just made him cuter. And he tried to teach me to drink, and I wasn't a very good candidate. But I can remember when he would get that GI check, and he would buy a six-pack, and I would get one, and he would get five. And I thought that was okay, too. Life was good. Full of dreams and promises for us. And we lived for a year in Tulsa. He was government attorney with the Department of Interior. And we had a great year up there. A lot of his fraternity brothers lived there. And it was party time. And it was fun. No problems. One day he came in and he said, you know, I would really like to move back to the short grass country, hang out a shingle and practice law. And you know, that was okay with me. I can remember never questioning what he said we should do. And we did. We moved back to Waurika. He hung out a shingle. We got involved in the community, the church, and all the civic clubs. And we were a promising young couple. A lot of couples back from the war then. A lot of parties. And Oklahoma was dry, but it wasn't long before Clee was appointed county judge. And we had access to all the confiscated hooch in the sheriff's vault. And we were a very popular young couple. We built a little house, and about the only thing that did not happen like I planned and dreamed was a baby. I so wanted a baby. And after we moved in our house, I told him, I said, I really think I should start seeing some specialist. And we did. We made a round of the specialist. Finally, after many, many tests, a wise old doctor sat me down and he said, "Nell, in all probability, you'll never bear a child." Here was a great big no in my life. And I'd heard as a child that God was my heavenly father. And so you know what I did? I cried and I quivered my chin and batted my eyelashes and all of the things. Because I thought, if God is half as good as my earthly father, I've got it made. But you know, I thought God said no. And I couldn't change it. And I was angry. I didn't understand. And I can remember shortly after I came to you, I read a little thing one time that said, God's no is simply a prelude to a much better yes in your life. And I know that now. And I hope today I share my better yeses, because there have been many, many better yeses to the no's in my life. We were married about 8 years, and here we were childless. Cleve was drinking a little too much then, but he always had such a wonderful excuse. I believed him. One day he came in and he said, "Nell, there's a little six-year-old boy in this town that needs and wants a home as much as we need and want that child." And I wasn't too happy about the age, because I had planned and dreamed on a baby. But I saw Mike. He was staying with a neighbor. His mother had died, and his dad spent most of his time in the beer joint. We knocked on the door, and Mike came to the door, a little bitty thing. And I said, "Hi, Mike." And he looked at me and he said, "How did you know my name?" I knew he was mine. I knew his name. And we took that little boy home, and his father signed the consent papers. And life was good. He crawled up in my lap and he said, "You're my third mother and the goodest one I ever had." You know, that punched all my buttons. So I simply decided that we weren't going to drink anymore. Here we had this little boy. We had our home. We had a family now. Party days were over. We had to get down to business. And I can remember the look on Cleve's face when I suggested this, too. You know, I think you call it sheer terror or something like that. But he told me, he said, "I'll tell you what, Nell, I won't drink in front of the boy." And I thought that was okay. But I didn't know. I didn't know what was going to happen. He didn't drink in front of the boy. He started coming home drunk a lot. Alcoholism is a family disease. I don't know when it manifested itself in him, but I can look back now and see how I reacted to that. I would get up in the morning and have nothing but fear, anxiety, guilt. I thought, I'm the reason he's drinking like this. Maybe it's because I couldn't bear him a child. I didn't know, but I was guilty. I was guilty. I didn't know. I didn't know what to do with the feelings. I didn't want anyone to know what was going on in our house. And things would get a little better sometime. And he'd tell me, you know, that he realized he was drinking too much, but pressures at the office, his his dad had died, and here we were with all this responsibility, and he had to take over the abstract company, and just all these things. That was the reason he was drinking too much. I wanted to believe that because I didn't want to believe it was me. I couldn't believe it was me. The feelings didn't go away. About 3 years after we adopted Mike, I got a phone call one day about a little tiny baby girl. She weighed 3.5 pounds. She'd been in the doctor's home and off the ventilator and was taking nourishment and maintained a steady body temperature, so they told me. I didn't know anything about this. I didn't question it. I knew that baby was mine, and we went after her. But not until Clee promised me that things were going to be different. He didn't lie. They got worse. So here I was. People were finding out what was going on, too. Mainly because he wound up in jail a lot. No longer in public office, in private practice. And I was scared. What was I going to do? I went to my doctor. I went to my minister. And they answered my questions with questions like, how do you stand it and why do you stay? I didn't know. I didn't know why I stayed. I know today that I stayed simply because I had become emotionally dependent on him for all of my neurotic needs. That sounds crazy to people that don't know what I'm talking about. But you see, we get comfortable in the sickness too, don't we? We're scared to make a move. We don't know what to do if things change. As I said, I can remember when people found out. Now, if you don't live in a small town with a practicing alcoholic, move. Society will condone your every action. Like I say, when they found out, I started going to town without makeup because you look more pitiful that way. And I'd go into the stores, and invariably someone would come up and put their arms around me and say, "Oh, Nell, how do you stand it, honey?" And I'd say, "I don't know." It was wonderful. It was just wonderful. You know, that worked for a while, but pity just does not get it, does it? And there was one couple in Warika who were attending AA in Al-Anon in Wichita Falls. And it was a guy that Cleve had gone to school with. And he knew Cleve was drinking too much. And he said to him one day, he said, "Cleve, I'm celebrating my AA birthday pretty soon. Would you like to go to a meeting or two with me beforehand? And then I'd like for you and Nell to go to my birthday party." And for some reason, Cleve told him he would do this. And I can remember that I was so excited when he went to that meeting. I didn't know why. I didn't really know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. But Cleve said he would go. And after that, he would promise me on occasion that he was going to quit drinking. And I think he even went to a little place. They didn't have recovery places then, but they had a drying out place in Wichita Falls, and Cleve went over there, drank orange juice and honey for a week. And it was during that stay, I'll have to tell you this, I really found it necessary to kind of know where he was all the time and what he was doing. So one day I got a babysitter and drove to Wichita Falls to this little place where he was drying out. And he was sitting in a sunroom with some guys drinking coffee. And I was being my clever, sarcastic self. And there was an old guy sitting at the table with him. And he said, "Cleve, you really have to learn to laugh when you ain't tickled." So And I thought he was trying to tell him that here he was with this darling, funny little wife, and that he just wasn't responding as he should. Took me a while to know what he really meant. Alcoholism is a family disease. But nothing I was doing was making any difference. And the wife of this man who asked him to go to a meeting with him asked me to go to Al-Anon. Now, I did not know what she was talking about, but I told her I would go. And I walked into a meeting in Wichita Falls, Texas, and I saw happy people. Now, I kind of like that. I didn't like being around people that weren't happy. I knew that I wasn't happy. But also, I saw a group of people who had not heard what I was going through. And I proceeded to tell them. Now, the chairman that night was a little rude. She would interrupt me from time to time and try to take control of her meeting. And they kept talking about the steps, and I kept looking around for steps. I didn't see any steps. And when there was a lull, I jumped back in there with something that I wanted to share. And what had dawned on me was that this was the place where you go to learn how to sober them up. I figured that out and nothing flat. So here was my training school. Finally, somebody pointed to the steps, and there were things on the wall. You know, I didn't expect that, but I read them just to be polite. And when you were reading the steps tonight, or this afternoon, I remembered when you came to 12, what I picked out was carry the message. I thought you could pick anything you wanted to out of these steps and use it. So I was going to carry the message to Cleve. And I went in the AA room and I gathered up all of the free literature. And I would go to open AA meetings and listen to everything they said. I tastefully decorated the house with the literature. And I knew when he did not pick it up, so I read it to him. And I would go in the morning and they said things like, whatever you do, do with love. So I would go in the breakfast table, get us a cup of coffee and say, Cleve, I love you. And I have something wonderful I want to share with you today. And as I read, Cleve would choke on his coffee. I thought he was getting emotional over what I was sharing with him. But nothing was working. Nothing was working. And you know, I didn't know why. I kept going to those meetings waiting for someone to give me an instruction book. A book that would tell me just exactly what to do. You see, I didn't know they already had. I didn't listen because I wasn't hearing what I wanted to hear. What I knew was the answer. I did that for about 3 years.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
I did hear them say things like, you can change the tone in your home by how you treat the alcoholic. I didn't know that. I didn't know I could do that. And they said, tell the children that your daddy is sick. And I told them that. I bet they wondered what was wrong with me, don't you? They knew what was wrong with him. Cleve wore black when he drank. He wore a black suit, black string tie, black boots, colored glasses, and a black hat. Now, when he left the house in the morning, I would stand at the door and say, if anything happens to him, he's dressed for it. Sometime we would come in and find him lying in state in the living room floor in all of his black. And I think Rebecca's first sentence was, is he dead? I'd say, no, darling, Daddy's just resting. And we're going to play a little game, and it's called Jumping Over Daddy. I said, Mother will show you how. I jumped first, and I kicked him. And I would say, oops, Mother missed. I'll have to do it again. Did you ever hide a drunk? Have you ever tried to hide them? Ah, that's an experience. One afternoon, I had a table of bridge coming, and God, here he came. Here he walked in the door as drunk as a waltzing polecat. You know how they are. There was no way I could convince him anything else was wrong. So I told him to go to the basement. I said, the girls just can't see you like this. Do not embarrass me again. And for some fool reason, he went to the basement. Mike was outside. And just as we had the cards dealt, and I had this look on my face that everything's all right, you know what to do. Mike came running in the back door, said, Mom, he's getting out. What are we going to do? Alcoholism is a family disease. Yeah. Nothing was happening. I obviously had the wrong book. We'd met a couple in Wichita Falls when Cleve would go to meetings under duress. And you know, they were different. Ruby Dee and Corny. Aren't those good Texas names? I just love it. They would come to see us. Now, I had a rocker in my living room that I was most pitiful in. I placed that rocker where it faced the front door. And on a really pitiful day, I would have Rebecca in my lap. In fact, I think I rocked her until her little feet drug the floor. And sometimes Mike sitting at my side, tears streaming down my face. And when anyone came by, they were going to say, what's wrong? And of course, it was always him. And I would tell them the latest thing, how humiliated we were. Well, this happened one day in May of 1965, the early part of May. And Ruby Dee and Corny came by. And I was in my chair, most pitiful. Cleve was in jail. Corny said, after I had told him this sad, sad story, Corny looked at me and he said, Cleve's an alcoholic, Nell, what's your problem? Thank God for that man. Thank God for the words he put in his mouth that day. But most of all, thank God I heard what he said. You know, I'd had the book all along. I had the right book all along. The things you had shared with me flooded my being. I had stuck them up there somewhere. But I didn't want them because I didn't think they'd work. I think we have to be as beaten down sometimes as the alcoholic before we really, really look up and take the hand that's held out to us. I remember the prayer that I prayed that day. I said, oh God, I've tried to help you and you didn't listen. So I'm going to give Cleve to you. And, you know, I thought I got even with God that day. But I added something to that prayer, and I said, please, God, help me. Just help me. Oh, my, he has. You know what I love about Al-Anon? I love the fact that there's always something new for me to learn. And with each thing that I learn in here, I have a new freedom. You know, I find that I'm not content with just being. I can't be content with just being. I can't be content with just doing. I have to be becoming. And you tell me that I will forever grow if I stay close and stick to the principles of this program. I am so grateful for the alcoholic. I'm so grateful for the program that they gave us. I am so grateful for the todays in my life because of people like you. The funny thing that happened shortly after I let Cleve go and gave him to God, he felt the relief and the release as surely as I did. 2 weeks later, he had his last drink. I know today that God's timing is right. It's always good. I know today that Cleve Larton could not have stayed sober if I had not started my own recovery. At least that's what I believe. And you know, we started this road together. We didn't have a group in Waurika then. We made meetings within a 100-mile radius of that town every night. Every night that there was a Al-Anon meeting and an AA meeting, the two couples were in a car going somewhere. The meetings in the car going and coming were just as good. We were together. We were a family. We were in recovery. One of the things that I learned was that has been probably one of the greatest blessings of my life was about forgiveness. And I had a hard time forgiving some of these things that had happened. And somebody in here said, God will do for you what you can't do for yourself. And I can remember looking out a window in my bedroom every day praying that I would know this forgiveness. And it seemed that I prayed this prayer for a long, long time. But then it happened. And you know, The freedom that gave me. I know that I was forgiven, too, because I could forgive. And I've told this so many times. I keep this thing pasted in my old dad that says, he who cannot forgive others breaks the bridge over which he himself must cross. Because we all stand in need of being forgiven. But I think that that was one of the strongest things in my relationship with this man, was this power of forgiveness. And the only reason I even need to remember the things that happened is because I can compare that with where I am today and what forgiveness has done for me. I don't remember any of these things with anger or bitterness. They were part of my journey to get me where I am today. And we had a wonderful life together. A week from today, we would have celebrated our 61st wedding anniversary. I will celebrate it, and I think he will be there in spirit too. Last year on our 60th wedding anniversary, some of you will remember this song, some of you won't, but he woke me up singing, "You may not be an angel. Angels are so few. But until the day that one comes along, I'll string along with you." And you know, I'll hear that again next week. I have found on this new road I'm on, grief is a strange thing. And I find that there are times when I feel so light. And I think, maybe it's over. And then it's not. Hits you like a ton of bricks. But I also know that as I get the components of my own life together, that I'm going to find out something that I've never known before. And one of the things that I have found out is that I have such a wonderful storehouse of memories. And these memories are blessings. These memories also let me know that I will always have this wonderful relationship with a man I have loved so long. Even though he's not sitting where I can see him. I used to love to have him sit right down there when I talk. You know, I never cracked a smile. Many of you know. But I thought that it was good for him to hear how much I suffered. This is a great journey. Let me tell you what I found when I first came to Al-Anon. What you were giving me long, long before I knew was a vision beyond my circumstances. And that's what I always look for today in these meetings with people I know, is that vision when I need it beyond my circumstances. I don't doubt it. I don't doubt that it will be there. And I know that I have to be ready. I have to be ready for that. Well, on this journey, I discovered a lot of things. You know, we look at the alcoholic, or most people look at the alcoholic, and they say, look what he's doing to his family. I ask you to look at the non-alcoholic. Our kids knew what was wrong with him. Now, when this dawned on me, I went to my sponsor, and I said, how can I ever, ever make amends to my children? I wasn't abusive, physically abusive. I was emotionally abusive. Even though I was there, I was not present for them. How do you make amends for that? She said, it's very simple, honey. You just don't act that way anymore. Why do we make it so hard? You just don't act that way anymore. You know, in spite of me, my kids have turned out great. They have been absolutely marvelous during the past few months. They adored their daddy. They were so good to him. They helped me take him to the doctor. They helped me in so many ways. You know, Rebecca is absolutely her daddy's girl. And I used to wonder if she'd ever be worth killing. She's a great little mom. Has wonderful kids that are good to me. They live close. And Stephen, the one that I've really gotten to be with a lot, just graduated from college. Now, I want you to know something. He's coming out here the 1st of July. And we'll be seeking his career. And I think he plans to succeed because he has told me he will take me to the Oscars with him. Let me tell you how this all started. He used to come to my house and he'd say, "Hey, Meme, today I'm Batman and you are Commissioner Gordon." I wanted to be Catwoman. But he told me his mother was Catwoman. I was Watson to his Sherlock. I never had a very good role. But he's a wonderful young man. And if he comes out here, be good to him. I don't think right now that you'll find him in these rooms, but I am so proud of him. Mike, that little boy that thought I was the goodest mother in the world, told me the other day I still was. He takes care of all the things that need taken care of. He had three wonderful kids. He and his wife divorced, and the kids all live in Florida. But they have made me a great grandmother 6 times and another on the way. And there was the baby I prayed for. I had that baby after about three years of sobriety. And I didn't know it was the baby I prayed for. Because you see, he had Down syndrome. But he's taught me more. He has really epitomized what this program is all about. Because he's nothing but pure love. Monica had his 40th birthday party and his 41st. You see, that's a national holiday to him. He loves it. He brought me an envelope the other day. He cuts out pictures of things he wants for his birthday. We don't usually start that until July. But he's got it on the dresser in his bedroom for me to look at any time, I'm sure. He lives in Duncan, 25 miles from us. He works. He lives in a house with 3 housemates. They rent their own home. They have a choice of where they will live. And they have a lovely 4-bedroom, 4-bath home and someone to take care of them. Would I change him? No. Not at all. Because if I did, I would have missed so much. When he was 9 months old, he sat alone, and I would rejoice because he sat alone. No one gave me a timetable or told me that he would be able to do anything. And I looked at him, and I held him, and I thank God that he simply sat alone. And I said, "Nell, this is how God loves you. Just the way you are. Your progress is slow, but you're learning to sit alone." What greater gift could a mother be given? I've watched him help with communion at church. The first time he did it, he crossed himself as he took the sacraments back to the table. That's not unusual in some churches, but we're Methodists. And He's kind of a monkey see, monkey do guy, you know. And he called me not long ago, and he had didn't have any money for a garage sale. And I said, "That's too bad, Chris. Maybe you should start saving your money during the week and not buy so many Cokes." And he didn't like that answer. You know, takes after his mother, I guess. And I'm sure that he went to his room and tried to figure out how to make that happen, so he called 911. And, well, they told him in case of an emergency, you know. So it wasn't long before I got a call from the one taking care of them at the house and said, "I have an incident report." So the ambulance and the police pulled up, and there's Chris standing in the door. And, of course, they looked at him, and he didn't get arrested. I was grateful for that. Would I change anything? No. No. Life is good. Life is wonderful. He misses his dad. He came home the weekend of May 2nd, which was Cleve's belly button birthday. And he wanted to take flowers to the cemetery, and I said, no, we're going to take balloons. So we got helium-filled birthday balloons, and we went to the cemetery, and we sang Happy Birthday. And we let those balloons go and rise, and he stood there and he watched that. And when we could no longer see them, he said, they made it. No, I wouldn't change anything. I'm going to share with you a story that was sent to me after Chris was born. It's called Welcome to Holland. And this is a story that the woman wrote about raising a handicapped child. But I share it with you because I think it's just simply living life. When you're expecting a baby, or we can insert here, living life, it's much like planning a trip to Italy. You can't wait to go. You buy all of the books. You learn a little bit of the language. And you start reading about all of the places that you're going to see. And you find out a little bit about the people. Oh, you're excited. And the big day arrives. You've packed and you board the plane and you fly and you fly. Then you land. And the flight attendant comes up to you and says, "Welcome to Holland." And you say, "I'm not getting off here. I'm going to Italy." And she says, "No, there's been a change in plans. This is where you get off." Ever been to Holland? I want to tell you something. I'm in a Holland, you might say, of my life right now. But I'm going to tell you my experiences in Holland. What I have found out. Holland has a very, very special beauty all its own. Windmills, tulips. I wouldn't have missed it. And I might have if I didn't have such a wonderful, wonderful travel agent. I call him God. I've had tour guides you wouldn't believe. They're people like you. And because of that, I have really, really found the beauty in Holland. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.